This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Best and worst cities for college hoops fans. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
As conference tournaments wrap up this weekend and the NCAA tournament tips off next week, we'll examine a new study that measures winning and losing cities.
You may have heard them mentioned recently as a way to lower the cost of health care. We'll dive into health savings accounts.
When hitchhiking for a dollar is a more effective way to get to work than Uber or Lyft.
And the evolving local shopping mall, out with Macy's and in with a supermarket.
So some of these local malls, in an attempt to get more shoppers into their locations, they are including grocery stores like Wegmans or Whole Foods or Kroger's. From what I heard from consultants who look at tenant mix in shopping malls, this actually is pretty common in places like Europe and Asia, where malls would also have grocery stores.
Wall Street Journal reporter Esther Fung on how a grocery store could help struggling malls. She's here in about 20 minutes. Well, after a cordial transfer of power, President Trump and former President Obama have publicly criticized each other to an unusual degree, punctuated by Mr. Trump's claims that Trump Tower in New York was wiretapped by Mr. Obama's administration. With a deeper look, here's New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker. Peter, set this up.
Well, listen, most presidents coming in and their predecessors aren't necessarily best of friends, right? A lot of them happen to either have beaten their predecessor or from the other party. But they usually try to ignore each other or at least, you know, have kind of a quiet tension. This is nothing quiet about this. You have outgoing president of the United States whose people have been very vocal from the very start, what they call the resistance, some of them call it, in criticizing some of President Trump's policies. And President Trump is convinced that some of these holdovers from the Obama administration are sabotaging him. But then he's taken this and gone nuclear with this allegation, unproven, that President Obama actually tapped his phones. And that's something, you know, the kind of likes of which we haven't seen in modern times.
Yeah. I guess in some ways it might not be surprising, right? Because as you point out, back during the campaign, I mean, here's Mr. Obama calling Mr. Trump a con artist and a know-nothing, and Mr. Trump responding with Mr. Obama being the worst president in history. So was the foundation laid for something like this to happen?
Well, they certainly weren't on the same page, these two guys. Actually, they never even met in person until after the election, ironically, at that post-election meeting at the White House, where each of them put on a game face and pretended to be friends, or at least, collegial with each other. So, personality-wise, you couldn't find two different types of people. And policy-wise, too, you know, as Newt Gingrich said for this piece, Trump stands for everything. Trump promises, in effect, to disrupt everything Obama stands for. There's, in Obama's point of view, these are important values of the country, not just simple policy differences, so that there's a lot at stake. So, maybe it wasn't surprising that they would sort of come, they would come in conflict in some way or another, but it has happened with remarkable speed and with remarkable ferocity, especially after this last weekend's claim by President Trump.
You said in the piece that inside the Trump White House, it's an article of faith that people seated throughout the government by Mr. Obama have been leaking everything they can get their hands on to damage the new president. Why is that? Why is that feeling?
Well, look, they pick up the paper every morning, and for 6 weeks, they see all these kinds of things, including these draft executive orders that they have been working on but hadn't actually finalized yet, or these contacts with the Russians that are being written about. And so, they are looking around the room and realizing these are not Trump people. Yet around them. He hasn't gotten most of his appointees in place yet for the jobs that are open to political appointments, and a lot of the jobs around him are civil service, which are not open to his political appointments, and the civil service is not, of course, thought to be particularly sympathetic to President Trump. So there's a great deal of suspicion about the people who are literally in the room with him, which is why, of course, they have been keeping some of these people out of the room, sometimes to their own detriment, because it means that they don't have some of the expertise that they could use in crafting some of these policies.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Peter Baker, chief White House correspondent at the New York Times. His piece is called Trump's Wiretapping Claims Puncture Veneer of Presidential Civility. To be fair, you point out, too, that right after Inauguration Day, some former Obama administration officials, like, you know, attend this women's march in Washington. They're on the TV talk shows. They're in op-eds talking about the new president's policies. Is that unheard of to kind of go on, I don't know, attack on day one?
It may not be unheard of, but it goes against sort of what President W. Bush, George W. Bush, had sort of established just 8 years ago as his approach, which was he said, my successor deserves my silence. And a lot of the people around him, more or less, for at least a few months, basically took their cues from him and said, yeah, let's kind of lay off the new guy for a while, let him get his feet planted before we start to have a public debate about some of these things. Not everybody agreed with that. Vice President Cheney, in particular, was very outspoken in the early months of the Obama administration. But, you know, in this case, the Obama people tell you, look, you know, the stakes are too big here. This is not within the normal range of differences that we had with the Bush people, for instance, that this is a reckless president, and therefore we have an obligation to speak out from the beginning, particularly when we are being attacked by him and when we have the right to defend ourselves. That's what they would say. What you hear from the Trump side is that they're under assault. That's the way they look at it, and they say that no other president has been subjected to this in such an intense way. Of course, it's all magnified by the proliferation of social media and all these different ways that people have now to get their views out there.
Thanks, Peter. New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker. It's 12 minutes after the hour on this weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. In his recent speech to Congress, President Trump said he'd like to expand health savings accounts as part of a plan to replace Obamacare. What exactly is an HSA? Think of it as a 401k, but for healthcare. For more details, we're joined by Kevin McKechnie, executive director of the American Bankers Association's Health Savings Accounts Council. Kevin, help us out here.
Happy to help. HSAs are tax-advantaged accounts that, when you pair them with a qualified high-deductible health plan, constitute major medical insurance. And the HSA comes with three distinct tax advantages, which are, as you contribute to the account, every dollar is deductible to you, the account owner. It grows tax-free and rolls over time. It comes out of the account tax-free for qualified medical expenses. And when you're age 65, you also have the choice of taking out as regular income. You don't have to pay the penalty. You just pay income tax on it, which is presumably lower now that you're retired. Mm. Or you can keep using the dollars in the account to pay for qualified medical expenses. That is, all the things that Medicare doesn't pay for. And that number is a big number. Fidelity says a husband and wife retiring today need $272,000 just to make up the difference between what Medicare reimburses and what your costs are going to be.
Yikes. How do you start contributing? Can that come directly out of your paycheck?
It can come directly out of your paycheck. It can come from your mom. It can come from any source. It's deductible to you. Since the overwhelming majority of HSAs are in the employer environment, it tends to be salary reduction, and that is a very efficient way to contribute to the account, but you're not limited to that. In other words, you can make the maximum contribution to your account either through salary reduction, or you can simply go and deposit the funds yourself at your bank.
All right. Well, what if your company doesn't have something like this? Can you do it on your own?
You can't if you're qualified by other insurance. And this is an important thing. If you are receiving insurance benefits from your employer and they are not HSA qualified plans, then you're ineligible to open HSAs. And so that's very key. You've got to make sure that you're not covered by other insurance. And one more thing, you can't be considered a dependent on anyone else's tax return.
Okay. All right. So to follow up on that then, let's say I work for somebody, a company that does not offer health mm-hmm. insurance, then what? Can I still take advantage somehow?
You can't. What you have to do is have a very frank conversation with your CFO and the director of HR about the benefits that you would accrue if you were insured by HSA-qualified plans, and you have to wait for your employer to offer them unless you're able to disenroll from that structure. If you can disenroll from the structure, then you become an eligible individual. But keep in mind, most of the time, employers are paying two-thirds of the premium for a family plan and about three-quarters of the premium for an individual plan, and you couldn't accept any of that money. you could only take perhaps a contribution to your HSA, but you couldn't accept any of the premium dollars. And so from a financial perspective, I would counsel, if you've got an offer of insurance from your employer with generous premium subsidy, you're going to want to say yes, even if it's not HSA qualified, until the employer makes the conversion.
We're speaking with Kevin McKechnie, Executive Director of the American Bankers Association's Health Savings Accounts Council. We're talking about what is an HSA, a health savings account. Are there limits as to how much you can sock away each year?
There are, and they're described in the IRS code. The maximum contribution for an individual is $3,400. For a family, it's $6,750. You probably read a little something about the House Republican proposal, which would increase those contribution limits to what is the maximum out-of-pocket liability for people in these plans. Those numbers are much higher. An individual could contribute $6,550, a family $13,100. Because the share of costs due to, through employees is rising so sharply, we're very much in favor of those contribution increases, but we've been in favor of them for years. So this is just a very nice development as far as we're concerned.
And not to confuse issues, but this is a health savings account, so that's different from a flexible spending account where you lose the money if it doesn't get spent, right? This is a health savings account, so as you said, it rolls over from year to year.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And they are all consumer-directed plans, but flexible spending arrangements have very important differences from health savings accounts. And the number one is an HSA is owned by the person. And so if you are HSA qualified, you own the money in your account. If you have a flexible spending arrangement, your employer owns the account. And no, FSAs do not roll over generally year over year, although there is an important carryover provision for about $500 in the FSA world, but it's not major medical insurance at all. HSAs are.
Got it. Who wouldn't choose to be part of an HSA, for example?
Hard for me to answer that because it's a very smart idea. As I said, you're going to need all this money in retirement.
Yeah.
This is the only plan in America that lets you accumulate it. So what do you have to lose is a very good question to have answered.
Thanks, Kevin. Kevin McKechnie, Executive Director of the American Bankers Association Health Savings Accounts Council. It's 22 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, where helping business grow is pure Michigan. Mall landlords are now eagerly courting a type of retailer they once ignored, grocery stores. As the internet reshapes the way Americans shop, landlords of mid and low quality mall properties are adapting to stay relevant, trying everything from restaurants to indoor skydiving. Now, Wall Street Journal reporter Esther Fung says a few are bringing in supermarkets. Esther, what's trending?
So some of these local malls, in an attempt to get more shoppers into their locations, they are including grocery stores like Wegmans or Whole Foods or Kroger's in spaces that were perhaps formerly a department store.
Wow. So the benefits here, let's talk about the pros first. What would the pros be?
Okay. The pros would be people would buy their groceries perhaps as many as a few times a week, and drawing people into the center, but they might be also encouraged to shop in other neighboring stores near the grocery. So that would help boost sales in the mall.
Mm.
And there's also an interest in some of the food options, the food and dining options that some of these grocery stores are also introducing.
Well, that'd be really unusual, wouldn't it, to see a grocery store going up in some of these malls that what normally a Macy's or a JCPenney's might have been in?
That's right. So in Natick Mall in Massachusetts, Wegmans is replacing, I think, a former JCPenney space. So that might be a little bit... different, but from what I heard from consultants who look at tenant mix in shopping malls, this actually is pretty common in places like Europe and Asia, where malls would also have grocery stores.
Oh, so are the buildings would they be similar in size? The spacing is okay.
So some of these grocery stores may not take the entire space that a department store might have occupied. So. It might be a little bit smaller, and they might lease the remaining space to other tenants that have similarities to the grocery store. One of the things that they mentioned was that these grocery stores need to be very easily accessible to the parking lots as well. You don't really want to be carrying your groceries across a crowded mall.
Oh, yeah. Right. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Esther Fung. Her piece is called Coming Soon to Your Local Mall, Celery and Dog Food. All right, so what about the cons here? You mentioned it a little bit there in terms of kind of the proximity to your car being close to your grocery store, because you don't want to obviously trek half a mile.
Yes, that's right. And it would make sense if the grocery store has an entrance next to the parking lot, as well as an entrance inside the mall. It makes it easier for shoppers to from the mall to also maybe cap their shopping trip with some time at the grocery store. Mm. In places where perhaps there are more seniors, they really want the parking lot to be near the grocery store.
Yeah.
And they might not do as much cross shopping in the other stores in the mall.
Thanks, Esther. Esther Fung, Wall Street Journal reporter. Two other examples, by the way, College Mall in Bloomington, Indiana, plans to bring in 365 by Whole Foods Market in the fall. Kroger has purchased a former Macy's location at Kingsdale Shopping Center in Upper Arlington, Ohio. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Are you looking for a great wine at a great price? The solution is Cameron Hughes Wines. He's got a fascinating story. Cameron Hughes has relationships with these high-end wineries and producers all around the world, where he sources his wine and sells direct to you for much less than you'd pay under other labels. His wines deliver on price, value, and quality. Best price, best wine, quality guaranteed. The best part is Cam guarantees all his wines. If you're unhappy with any bottle you buy from him, he'll make it right. Now, Cameron Hughes doesn't typically offer discounts because his prices are so much less than retail, but he's offering our listeners a fantastic deal on your first order of three or more bottles. Free shipping on that order and a sommelier-grade corkscrew. Only if you go to chwine.com and use my code DEAL. The only way to get free shipping and your free sommelier corkscrew, go to chwine.com. chwine.com. Shop for your wine. Enter my code DEAL at checkout. Don't wait. It's a limited time offer. This wine is fantastic. The deal is phenomenal. And I want you to go online and order it today. Again, chwine.com with the code DEAL. Thanks for being with us, Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Coming up this half hour, new ways to book trips with your airline miles. Also, the best and worst cities for college hoops fans and hitchhiking to work for a dollar. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, the CIA has declined to confirm whether the leaked documents were authentic or comment on the status of any investigation here with regards to this WikiLeaks scandal. Meanwhile, WikiLeaks calls it the largest intelligence publication in history. So what now? More from Patrick Tucker, technology editor at Defense One. Patrick, what's up?
One reason why a lot of people are in a lot of alarm, and the CIA doesn't comment as to whether or not this is real or this isn't real, but a lot of people are saying this looks like information, like documents, tools, and things that the CIA would actually use. And if you look at them, though, the level of alarm that different people have had about them, it's at first a lot of alarm, but then you dial it back and you realize what you're actually looking at. So some of the tools that they've talked about include methods for breaking or undermining very common, very popular encrypted messaging apps like Signal and WhatsApp and even Confide, which is the sort of newer encrypted app that is popular among people in the Trump administration who like to leak to the press. But at the same time, a slightly closer inspection shows that many of these encryption hacking tools can only be compromised using these tools if you actually have the physical phone itself. And there's a big difference between the CIA creating a cyber weapon that's going to break encryption on everyone's phone if it falls into the wrong hands, and a technique that a particular agent can use in the field as part of an operation to get a certain outcome. Now, here's the weird part, though. If you look at the actual thing that WikiLeaks dumped in the morning, there's a portion of it that speaks to the CIA kind of like offensive cyber weapons office, the office that actually makes these exploits and accesses. It's called Umbrage, and they say that Umbrage, WikiLeaks says this, Umbrage has stolen malware from Russian intelligence and military sources, and they can now use that to conduct hacking operations, to conduct cyber theft, and make it look like the Russians. So immediately, I read that, and a lot of other people read that. We sort of scratched our head for a moment, and we said, now this is starting to make sense a little bit. Yesterday, Russia Insider, and then RT, and then Sputnik, and then after that, Drudge Report, and then after that, Breitbart can all write articles and say, wait a minute, every time you hear about Russian hacking, you have to assume it's the CIA now. And that's the ultimate outcome of what this entire event actually means for everyone.
We're speaking with Patrick Tucker, technology editor at Defense One. His piece is called CIA Silent as WikiLeaks Claims to Publish Thousands of Agency Files. Did I read too, or do I understand that WikiLeaks actually withheld some stuff that may have been more sensitive?
Yeah, they redacted some names. They say that that's in order to protect certain people's identities, including sources that may be have been involved in the document dump. And they also say that they redacted some information so that they don't further proliferate the dispersal of cyber tools and cyber weapons. So they block some things out so that particular cyber weapons don't fall into the hands of more and more people, they claim. Which is a very unusual thing for WikiLeaks. They're very much known for just taking the entire file and throwing it up online and violating the privacy of a lot of people that are contained in those files, that sort of thing. So this is, at very least, a sign that they've learned basic etiquette and manners. But it's still a troubling development, particularly for the CIA. And a lot of people that I've talked to from a communications perspective, because right now their future communication strategy is being undermined from right out from under them, and there's very little that they're doing about it, because this is going to keep haunting them for months and months into the future, perhaps for years. Every time they observe something related to Russian cyber espionage activity, an entire sort of wing of media will suddenly start posting articles saying you can't trust the CIA when they cry Russian hacking, because they have these stolen malware tools and they probably did it themselves. And that's just going to follow them around for months, if not years.
It's Patrick Tucker, technology editor at Defense One. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Glad you're with us. Booking an airline ticket using frequent flyer miles has gotten so tricky that some savvy flyers are turning to professional help. For people who want good deals but aren't willing to invest hours searching and scheming, you can now hire a pro, of course, for a fee. Wall Street Journal airline writer Scott McCartney has a look at some of the services available. Scott, what did you put together?
Well, booking trips with miles has gotten more and more complicated. There are actually more avenues to do it, more options, as airlines have increased the number of partnerships that they have. You can use your miles to book awards on those partner airlines. They're not only shown on your airline's website. It takes some hunting, and that's added to the complexity. There are more fees and rules. There are more people have credit card points that you can transfer into various airline programs, sometimes at different exchange rates. So it's all gotten more complicated, and with that have come some services that much like travel agents, they're frequent flyer experts who help you book stuff, and some do-it-yourself online tools that can help you sort of navigate the very complicated maze of frequent flyer awards.
Really? All right, so what are some of these services that can help you book with your miles?
So they're mostly frequent flyer junkies who have kind of hung out their shingle as award experts, and typically you pay them $150 per person, sometimes discounted for multiple people on a trip, and you only pay if you use their suggestions. Book Your Award has been around for a number of years, run by a guy named Gary Leff, who is a well-known frequent flyer expert, if you will. He's been chasing miles for 20, 25 years. There's one called Points Pro. There's Mile Value. I Fly with Miles. Several different awards, several different services, and I think the real value is not only finding things that you might not otherwise find, but also advising you on when to use your miles, when to pay cash.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal airline writer and travel editor Scott McCartney. His piece is called New Ways to Book Trips with Miles. One of the strategies that I think it was Mr. Leff had mentioned, that's look at partner airlines for seats.
Yeah, so part of the problem here is that airlines have not made their partner awards universally available on their websites. So American Airlines, for example, has 26 different partners, and you can book award seats. You can book cash seats on any of them on their website, but award seats are different. And so award seats only show up for 8 of the partners. So if you search segment by segment, you can see more of what's available on British Airways' website, then take that information and say, hey, I want this Japan Airlines flight that didn't show up on the American website, but if you call American, you can probably book it.
Thanks, Scott. Wall Street Journal airline writer Scott McCartney, who's based in Dallas. It's 14 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, getting ready for one of the most exciting sports seasons of the year as we dive headlong into March Madness. This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka has a look at the best and worst cities for college basketball fans.
Is your city a good one to watch college hoops? That depends on a number of factors. Jill Gonzalez of Wallet Hub is here to analyze the situation for us. Number one, Chapel Hill. No surprise there. How did they do well in different categories?
Chapel Hill, pretty hard to beat, especially since they're doing so well, typically do so well. So that came in at number one, really high winning percentage, a lot of fans on social media from Facebook to Twitter. And although they don't have the best stadium capacity, of course it sells out every single game. So Chapel Hill was number one and Durham was number three.
No surprise there. In between there, Los Angeles. Is that just because they have so many college teams?
That's definitely one. Pauley Pavilion, of course, is a basketball mecca, so anything like that, huge stadium capacity at least, always sold out again, and a lot of fans, they do have that basketball tradition, even if not all of the teams have the highest winning percentages, especially over the past 3 years or so.
And Jill, Bloomington, Indiana, no surprise there at number four. And Philadelphia, another city with a lot of different teams and a huge following for a lot of fans, right?
Exactly. So the Hoosiers in at number four. The Big Ten in general has actually picked up some momentum, both in terms of winning streak and following over the past three seasons. And Philadelphia, such a basketball town, I think that it takes a lot of cues from its professional team as well.
We're speaking with Jill Gonzalez of Wallet Hub about good and bad places to watch college hoops on the worst end, some places in northern New York, Ithaca and Poughkeepsie. What's wrong with those places?
Yeah, Ithaca and Poughkeepsie, they both have teams, so they are on this list. But in terms of fan engagement, in terms of people showing up to games or even watching, their viewership rates, unfortunately, are just not competitive.
Let's talk about ticket prices. Lexington with the most expensive season tickets. Again, not really a surprise given Kentucky, right?
Right. So Lexington, certainly high here. Their minimum season ticket price is about $600. So that's about 20 times higher than many other places here on this list. Basketball, certainly you can get into games for free, or in this case, you certainly cannot. That's one reason why I got dragged down a little bit in these overall rankings.
Now, we talked about Chapel Hill and Philadelphia, Bloomington, some cities that you would expect rabid fans. Best performing college teams, a little bit of a surprise to me. Nacogdoches, Texas, Wichita, Kansas, Spokane. What do those places have in common?
Well, I mean, here we're really looking at the best performing teams. This is over the past three seasons, as well as this year, sheerly by regular season conference games. So all really good performers this year. We can expect teams from all of those cities to certainly, we think, make it far this year in match in the tournament itself.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Kashinka with Jill Gonzalez from WalletHub.com. It's 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Reminder, by the way, that we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook, or you can follow me directly on Twitter with the username at Gordon Deal. Glad you could be with us. So finally today, companies like Uber and Lyft, as you know, have spent billions of dollars to change how people get from point A to point B. You can throw the app Waze in there as well. Yet the Wall Street Journal says none of them has been able to dethrone casual carpool, a decades-old word-of-mouth hitchhiking system in the San Francisco area, home base for Uber and Lyft, by the way. To cross the Bay Bridge, the magic number of riders inside a commuter vehicle is 3, defined as the driver plus passengers. This way, you can enter carpool lanes and skip those backups at the toll booths. If drivers are short a body or two, they swing by one of about 24 stops around the East Bay to pick up random passengers. More than 6,000 people a day use casual carpool, according to one transit study. The median wait time for riders in line, by the way, about 2.5 minutes. The service is unregulated, but riders know they are supposed to at least offer $1 to help cover the $2.50 bridge toll, plus a little bit of the driver's gas. Unofficial rules here, by the way. No fragrances, no phone calls, and do not speak unless the driver does. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Kashinka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Transition seamlessly from presentation to meeting and from work to home with the Dell Latitude 13 7000 series, the laptop that takes care of business. The powerful performance and incredible battery life from this reliable business-class PC featuring Intel Core processors lets small business employees do their best work wherever work takes them. Learn more at Dell.com/radio. That's Dell.com/radio.